would like to introduce one of many sessions we've had this week with one of the extraordinary young Special Aspen Fellows who are invited to this festival at our invitation and our expense due to the generosity of many of you, 70 extraordinary young people from around the world engaged in wonderful activities, social entrepreneurs especially. I am going to introduce her, and then as soon as she finishes a very brief presentation of her big idea, I will turn things over to Clive Crook of The Atlantic to introduce and then moderate what will be a terrific panel. But now it's my pleasure to bring up Priya Berry, who's the director of Virgin Unite, the Virgin Group's charitable arm. Priya.
Good morning, everyone. So, as you know, I head up strategy at Richard Branson's Foundation, which is one fun endeavor after another. Today, I'm going to share with you my ideas on what you can do to maximize waves of positive change, to come up with a sea change in the world rather than just yet another good idea that we hear about but never see anything happen with. Look, I mean, we open the papers every day. All of us read a news story on climate change or AIDS, but we don't hear about the minimal return in investment we're getting on these issues. We don't hear about what's happening to make a difference. But if you take a look at the numbers, you see that over $6.5 million are spent by the Global Fund on AIDS, TB, and malaria every day. Over $7 million by the World Food Program are spent every day. In the health sector, in the global health sector, there's nearly 90 global bodies looking at health issues, and just as many global health initiatives and partnerships to deal with them. But yet, we're not making an impact. Nearly 16,000 people still die a day of AIDS, TB, and malaria. 10.5 million children die a year from treatable or preventable diseases. The list goes on, and adding climate change to the mix, it's going to get a whole lot worse. And you can even come up with better numbers than these, but you get the point. Whilst great strides are getting made and taken over the past decades, billions have been spent. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of organizations have emerged to make a difference, but there's loads of inefficiencies, and we're simply not seeing the scale of change that we need to be able to make a difference. In South Africa, where I spend much of my time, the overall devastation of AIDS and the health emergency is highlighted by hundreds of funeral signs that have replaced adverts for entrepreneurial small businesses that were once a symbol of hope for the future, a future free from poverty. The daycare centers are overflowing with orphans. There's 2 million now, and in 18 months there'll be 3 million. 3 million kids growing up without the love and guidance of their parents. But the funny thing is, there's more than $1 billion available for health in South Africa. And there's also over 100,000 organizations addressing HIV/AIDS and health issues in the country. But it's getting worse. It's not just a question of leadership. Why are we not coordinating? In theory, we all know exactly what to do. We've even heard incredible ideas just in the past few days. We're all leaders in this room. We're scientists. We're inventors. We're voices. We're business leaders. We all can make a difference. But I dare us all to say, so what? Is it enough to just have an answer or a perfect approach? Will Dean Kamen's incredible creations mean anything if we all can't work together to scale up that simple case study to a wave of transformation? Is it ethical for us as philanthropists, as policymakers, as inventors, to work in isolation when we can exponentially increase our impact through coordination? I'm putting a challenge to all of you to, yes, continue to run with your passion, your innovation, but one of the most valuable things you can do is to step back to one of the most foundational elements of the work, and that's to take a moment to coordinate. Do this so we can build the system that Thomas Friedman inspired us about a few days ago. Coordinate so we don't end up creating islands of excellence, silos, that are operating in parallel and achieving no economies of scale. Create a space for partnerships rather than turf wars and criticism. You know, about half of my day, every day, is spent in managing infighting between NGOs and the development community. In reality, the problems are massive. There's room for everyone to get involved. Connect with others rather than build walls. Challenge that human instinct that sparks us to be territorial and defensive. Open your doors to unlikely bedfellows. Take on the head of that UN agency that tells you, and this is in quotes, this is what they told me last week when I was in Geneva, "My dear, you have interesting ideas, but you must realize this is not your role. You all fly planes, don't you? And we've been tackling health for decades. So it's discouraging, but you have to keep knocking on that door. It's with this spirit that Richard Branson and Virgin Unite have jumped into bed with Thabo Mbeki and the South African Ministry of Health to create a war room to fight diseases in Africa, a move that's been dubbed a sin by the global health community, given the South African government's stance and position on HIV/AIDS over the past years. But this is precisely why it's an opportunity. The war room will be a new model, a new approach, breaking down the silos right down to the basics of information and data exchange. It will exist as a neutral body to analyze what's working. Most importantly, it will visualize who's doing what to map out all the players and build a platform for coordination. It can make sure that no disease runs out of control ever again in Southern Africa. Look, at the end of the day, there's no sexy aspect to coordinating. In fact, it can be truly painful, and it's downright boring. There's no patent, there's no Nobel. It's not rocket science, but let's keep our eye on that prize and challenge the value system to reward that unhuman behavior of coordination. Only then will we be able to maximize the impact of that $55 trillion that's going to come from U.S. donors, philanthropists over the next 40 years. Let's find a way to put that sexy back in coordination. So that's my relatively simple idea, big idea on what you can do, but I promise you it will make a difference. So with that, I'm thrilled to introduce the next plenary session, which is Election 2008, Turning Point for America, moderated by Clive Crook, a man who's constantly shaping our thinking and ideas through his leadership at The Economist and now a senior editor at The Atlantic. Over to you, Clive.
Thank you. Well, our topic is the election and the economy. Let me first of all say that the program shows that David Malpass was to be on the panel, and unfortunately he had to cancel. But I don't think he would mind me saying that we will get along fine without him, because the two people who are left are really perfect choices for this topic. Austin Goolsbee, who is a senior economic advisor to Barack Obama's campaign, and campaign head of outreach to foreign embassies. And Al Hubbard, who is the...
tough crowd, this is.
Al Hubbard is the president of ENA Technologies. Until recently, he was an economic advisor to George Bush and head of the National Economic Council. I wanted to just kick off by getting you to give us a reading on the state of the economy. Where are we right now? As you know, there are concerns being expressed that this slowdown has already turned into a recession, that things are going to get worse before they get better, and some economists have begun to call for a second big fiscal stimulus. So, Austin, we could start with you. Might things get worse before they get better, and what's your position on the need for another fiscal stimulus?
Senator Obama was one of the first out of the gate calling for the first stimulus and has said we do need a second stimulus, so why don't we start with that? Particularly as you look at the price of energy, you know, it's up 40-some percent in the last just couple of months. There's a massive dislocation. It's happening at a very rapid rate. Senator Obama's view is let's give energy-based rebates to people, to help them cover costs of energy, but the cost of a bunch of other stuff is shooting through the roof at the same time. Contrasting that with the approach that Senator McCain has put forward of let's waive the gas tax for the summer, I think it's clear the economics say you ought to put your lot with further stimulus rather than, let's call them more gimmicky things to just try to address the price of energy. Taking a step back and you say the state of the economy, we've had a significant slowdown. There's no question about that. I think on one hand, the GDP numbers have been surprisingly good, though being not very good overall. I think there was the view among a lot of economists that I know that it would have been negative in the first quarter, and it wasn't. We've kind of bumped along, not very good, but not horrible.
Right.
The job market has been pretty bad. most expectations, and I have no reason to doubt them, are that it will continue to get worse, because that's not the job performance is not a leading indicator of the business cycle. It tends to keep going. So we've lost jobs for six straight months, and that shows every sign of continuing. And there is a small, hopefully small probability, it's not the most likely outcome, but there is some chance that it deteriorates really substantially, and a lot of that has to do with what happens in the housing market and by consequence what happens in the financial markets, where there's still a lot of unrealized loss and nobody really knows what is left out there, or are we past the worst part.
So we're not out of the woods by any means?
Yeah, I don't think we're out of the woods, and we might be just getting into the woods, unfortunately.
Al, what's your reading on this?
Well, there's no question there's been a slowdown in the economy. These things unfortunately happen. We don't have economic growth that goes on forever. We're a long ways from ever figuring that out. The good news is, it's, as Austin pointed out, we're not in a recession. We grew at 1% in the first quarter. We'll grow at 1 to 2% in the second quarter. The stimulus package is working itself through the economy. I think it's certainly premature to be talking about a second stimulus package. I think it's not premature, though, to talk about the fundamentals of the economy and what's most important to ensuring the long-term economy is strong. Mm-hmm. And what Senator Obama is proposing would be devastating to the economy. What he wants to do, and I bet you 99% of y'all are not aware of this, he wants to raise taxes on people who earn more than $250,000 by 17.4%. 17.4%.
That's not actually his policy. But.
Secondly, he wants to increase. He wants to double the capital gains tax rate. He wants to eliminate make the dividends tax rate the same as the regular income tax rate.
That's
he wants to restrict trade. He wants to reverse the liberalization of trade that's been occurring since 1945. Result of which most economists would agree, and I'm sure, well, I'll let Austin speak for himself, but most economists would agree it's had a very positive impact on the bulk of Americans. The average income of the average family in America is $9,000 greater today than it would have been had we not liberalized trade policies. He wants to reverse that. So what's most frightening is if Senator Obama is elected, the slowdown will turn into a very negative economy because of significantly increased taxes and because of reversing the liberalization of trade and restricting trade. By the way, companies that are export market, that are export companies, they pay 15% more on average than other companies. And the real growth area of the economy today is exports. Last year we grew at 2.2%. Almost 1% of that growth came from exports. And the last thing in the world we want to do is reverse what we've done on trade.
Okay. Austin, I imagine you want to come back.
Well,
on
Clive,
the
I thought you had asked Al how the economy was doing, but I see that actually it was simply the opening barrage.
I'm worried about what the economy is going to do tomorrow.
Let us discuss two or three issues. Number one, you heard the sleight of hand at the start. These things just happen. He said, yes, we've had a slowdown. Unfortunately, these things just happen, and we have to work our way through it. This didn't just happen. This wasn't a random business cycle event that just landed on us. Ah, the economy slowed down. This was the very culmination of exactly the failed philosophy that we pursued for the last 8 years. Because there has been an 8-year squeeze on ordinary Americans. Indisputable. Income stagnant for about 85% of workers in the country. The very top, incomes growing rapidly. At the same time, incomes flat, job growth measly. You've had the cost of energy, the cost of health care, the cost of food, the cost of college education, all rising. Squeezed ordinary Americans to the point that they have literally zero savings. The personal savings rate went below zero in 2 quarters, meaning if you added up all the savings of the United States, it was less than nothing. In a situation like that, they turn to their houses and borrow money. They've now turned to their credit cards, and the stage is set for anything to go wrong and it will lead to a dramatic deterioration in consumer confidence, in consumer debt, consumer spending falls. That gets you into recession. That is exactly what happened. This recession is not caused because high-income people's incomes have not grown fast enough. The trickle-down theory didn't work in this case. That wasn't what happened. And so, if you then say, we've gotten to a situation where ordinary Americans aren't able to spend, they don't have the money, and that led to our slowdown, why turn back, as John McCain would do, to the same exact fail philosophy that got us to where we are today? That was exactly where we got. Now, the second point, you could put in the single largest line in Barack Obama's budget is tax relief for ordinary Americans. It's the single biggest thing in his domestic agenda. It is not about raising tax. There is absolutely, it is absolutely not true that he wants to add. What did you
say? He wants
why
to, he,
limit it at 17.4? He wants to raise, according to Al, 99% tax rates.
Does he want to take the ceiling off Social Security taxes?
No, he has never proposed the full-on capping of Social Security at 12.4%. He has looked at the policy of reforming Social Security, which is a 25-year process. He has said, before you ask, as John McCain would, for privatizing Social Security or for asking the retirees to raise the retirement age and cut their benefits, let us think about the regressivity of the payroll tax, where an oil CEO who makes $102 million doesn't pay 1 cent more in payroll tax than a person making $102,000. Now, there, as you know, are many proposals of how to do that in rates of 2%, 3%, 5%, looking just at the employer side. You could follow the international models, like in Ireland and others, where the uncapping are at very low rates. It is not, has never been, and will not be Senator Obama's policy to raise the top marginal tax rate by 9,000% or whatever was the allegation that Mr. Hubbard gave.
No, but
it is not his
maybe
policy.
By 10%, right? Maybe
it is by not by 10%. None of those are, A, it's not his policy. B, he has never talked about raising the marginal tax rate on Social Security payroll taxes by anything like that. That is completely fabricated.
That is absolutely untrue.
Well, hang on a second. He hasn't said. That's the point. He said that he'll raise the ceiling, but he hasn't said what the rate will be.
Okay? He has committed to raising rates. Look, as I say, this is in the context of reforming Social Security, which is what would happen 25 years from now. John McCain himself is on record saying he would consider raising the payroll tax. So you cannot put forward discussions about Social Security financing 25 years from now as if these are the discussions about what do we want the tax policy to be this year in response to recession. It's crazy. Further, it isn't – Barack Obama specifically said – that when capital gains goes back to rates that they were in the 90s, which is the overriding theme of his tax policy, is that let us have tax relief for 95% of workers and let us let the rates for those over $250,000 go back to what they were in the 90s. On capital gains, most of the 90s it was at 28. The end of the 90s was at 20. He has personally, he's closer to the bottom of the range, so capital gains go to something, let's say, 20, 22. And he specifically said dividends would go to the same rate as capital gains. So we're either going to get into a game of fear where they're going to get up and say, he's going to raise, and if he had his way, he'd raise the tax rate to 9,000%. And I have a secret bird that's told me that is his policy, regardless of what his economic advisor says the policy
well,
is.
You're right. On Social Security, he hasn't said. On Social Security, he just hasn't said, and as you say, neither has McCain. But let me put this to you. You know, we've had barrage and counter-barrage, and you're both, you know, implying, you know, through your manner that, you know, this is a hugely significant issue. You know, do we get President McCain, do we get Obama? According to the tax, and you've just been talking about taxes. According to the Tax Policy Center, nonpartisan outfit, Obama is planning to cut taxes by $2.7 trillion. McCain is planning to cut taxes by $3.7 trillion relative to current law. And the difference is almost entirely on the extra taxes that a tiny sliver of the population of the U.S. will have to pay. Now, whatever you think about the merits of that, is that all it comes down to? I mean, is that really all that's at stake in this election, the difference between a $2.7 trillion tax cut and a $3.7 trillion tax cut?
Look, it's a good question. I don't think it is for the following reason. If you're not a real budget wonk, you can plug your ears. The following may not be that interesting. Much of that determination has to do with what is your baseline. Okay, so the budget invention, which we would characterize as a gimmick that is created coming out of the Bush budgets, was the making of a lot of tax cuts temporary so that they wouldn't count in the budget window as costing very much money, but they would be signed into law that if you just play things out, a whole bunch of tax cuts expire. Now, relative to that world where all of the Bush tax cuts expire, it costs money to extend them for ordinary Americans. If you ask, however, okay, you've proposed for program, if you take as a more reasonable baseline a patch on the AMT, for example, extending the Bush tax cuts just for the people making less than $250,000, this same analysis you cited shows that Barack Obama's budget is paid for, that his tax plan does not increase the deficit relative to that scenario. It shows that even in the fudged tax policy that McCain gave to them, and I will point out to you that the New York Times and other budget experts who looked at it said they believe there's at least $1.5 trillion of additional tax cuts for very high-income people that McCain has proposed that they didn't give to the Tax Policy Center. You're looking at a situation where Obama provides large tax relief to the vast majority of Americans who are the ones facing the squeeze and whose problems have led us into the slowdown we are in. And McCain's program, one quarter of his tax cuts go to people making almost $3 million a year or more. Now, what is the point? Why are we doing that while simultaneously increasing the deficit by about $300 billion per year more than Obama does? I don't think it's a trivial matter. You're saying, is it really just the difference between 2.7 and 3.7? It's bigger than that, and the who's benefiting is really quite important. In Obama's program, the tax cuts for the middle class are three times bigger than McCain's. That analysis shows it. And it's just your focus. Do you think that the thing that we should do is repeat the same thing we just did for the last 8 years times two, so they're twice as big and twice as regressive as the Bush tax cuts in the McCain plan? Do you think that will work? My question is, how has the last 8 years of that worked out for you? And the answer is, not very well. We had two anemic, we've had two recessions / major slowdowns with one rather anemic recovery in between, which was the first recovery in U.S. history where the median family's income actually fell over the course of the boom.
Right.
That's not a track record that you want to pursue.
But
I think it's important.
But I know you don't think that that is because of the Bush tax cuts.
I believe that, there are too many negatives.
Well,
I do think the Bush tax approach where you have resources and rather than focus them on the people struggling, which could have resolved many of those issues of the last 8 years, to instead focus that on very, very high-income people is responsible for not preventing this thing from getting worse. So,
okay,
yes, I am
right.
Putting some of the blame on the Bush tax cuts.
All right. Please.
Austin, you've been taking up a lot of airtime.
Well, that's my fault, not his.
No, it's Al's fault.
Now she can.
I don't know where to start, Austin. You just slammed us in every direction. Are we responsible for the first recession?
No.
Oh, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
The president inherited a recession in 2001.
I agree with that.
He immediately cut taxes in 2001. He cut taxes in 2003. We had 52 weeks, which is a record in the history of the country since they've been keeping statistics of job growth. There's not been the wage growth that we would have liked. And there are two fundamental reasons for that. One is healthcare costs have gone through the roof. And when employers look at what they pay for their workers, they include the cost of healthcare, retirement, total compensation. And when you've got healthcare costs going through the roof and the employers are paying it, the people that are hurt by it are the employees. They're the ones it costs them in their wages. And then secondly, our economy, and this has been going on for 25 years, it will not change, and we need to accept it and deal with it. Our economy has been giving, every year we give a greater return to education. The better educated you are, the more money you make, because we are becoming a more skill set, high tech economy. And 30 years ago, a college degree was worth 45% more than a high school degree. Today, in 2006, it was worth 70% more than a high school degree. Now, there are two ways we can deal with this income inequality problem, and it is a serious problem, and I agree with Austin about that. There are two ways to deal with it. You know, you can pull the top down. You can say, you who are most successful, we're gonna make you less successful, so we'll reduce the income inequality, and that's what the Democrats want to do. We believe that what you should do is lift the bottom and pull the bottom and make it pull them towards the top. And you do that by improving education, improving job training, improving opportunity. And that's what the Republicans believe in. That's what John McCain believes in. That's what George Bush believes in. Now, I want to talk a little bit about taxes. And I think this is important because people do not understand it, because the media and the Democrats who get all the media talk about we are... We are an under...
I don't know what media you're talking about.
We are... I have so many friends in the audience, and I really appreciate that.
Not anymore.
Oh, I got one friend here. And I brought my wife, thank God.
She's booing.
My kids weren't available. That's since World War II, and by the way... And we've had both Democrats and Republicans since World War II, obviously, as leaders of the country. Our economy, for the most part, has been very, very strong. We're the strongest economy in the world among developed countries. Our average income as a percentage of GDP has averaged 18.1%. I had a slide, but somebody at the technology didn't get here that I was going to show this. But we've averaged 18.1%. We are currently collecting 18.8% of GDP. I happen to believe that when you tax something, you get less of it, and most economists believe that. So the point is, we are not an under-taxed society. At the current point, we're collecting more in taxes than we should, if we believe we shouldn't collect more in taxes than we've collected on average since the beginning of World War II. And so, therefore, the idea of extending President Bush's tax cuts is absolutely appropriate. We need to deal with the AMT. I don't know if people are familiar with that. Y'all tend to be higher income, so you're probably familiar with it. The alternative minimum tax, which is if you have to figure your taxes two different ways, and it's capturing more and more people. The idea was it was a tax for millionaires who have lots of deductions, but now if it's not passed, it goes as low as, I don't know, $200,000 or something. But the point is we can permanently patch the AMT. We can permanently extend the president's tax cuts, and we do not go below that 18.1% of GDP. So there is no reason for us to raise taxes on anyone. And you know, people say that the rich are undertaxed. I think 35% federal tax rate is a very significant tax rate. And you pay on top of that your state taxes, your local taxes, et cetera. I mean, taxes determine what your incentive is to work. I appreciate that.
That's all you got.
That's all a few. Thank you, Kathy.
Maybe you should stop.
I want to just mention one thing on Social Security, and this is important. I want you to understand what the problem is, and this is a concern that, you know, entitlements are – spending is a huge problem in America. You know, we just passed the Farm Bill, which made absolutely no sense. The president vetoed it. Republicans and Democrats voted to override his veto. Congress spends, and they look for every opportunity to spend, and the more money we give them, the more they're going to spend, and I hate to say it, Republicans are almost as bad as Democrats, or maybe even worse at times. If you look at the late 90s and you talk to people when we had the surpluses, that's when they really started spending money. But the point on Social Security, and this is important, Social Security today produces an $80 billion surplus. And guess where that money goes? You know, we have a unified budget, so that money goes to offset our other spending, and it just is all mixed together. Well, by 2017, that $80 billion surplus in Social Security goes to zero. By 2033, it's going to be a negative $300 billion and keep growing. Now, how do you fix that? You can't tax your way out of it. And I want to give you an example of why you can't tax your way out of it. It's unclear Senator Obama's position on lots of things. He's a moving target right now, as we all know. He changed his position twice on Iraq day before yesterday. Literally, he said he was going to reconsider about withdrawing troops, and then he said, I'm not going to reconsider about withdrawing troops. Here's the important point. If we lifted, right now you pay Social Security taxes on your first $102,000 of income. If we lifted that entirely, but kept the link, so if you pay more in Social Security taxes, you get more benefits, then we would go to zero rather than 2017, it would go to 2024. But then after 2024, we would start building these big deficits in the Social Security budget. Okay, if we delinked them, so we just made people who earn over $102,000 pay the 12.4%, but we didn't increase their benefits, then the surplus would turn to a deficit in 2025. It would only give us 8 years. The bottom line is we can't solve Social Security through taxation. The only way we can solve Social Security is we've got to reform the system. And unfortunately, as we all know, and I understand President Bush is not a very popular person here, he did everything he
possibly could. Or anywhere else.
Actually, you know, he's very popular in my household. It's an 80% approval rating. One of our daughters doesn't like him. But President Bush tried to get Congress to deal with Social Security unsuccessfully. And I was his point person. And I failed at that. But my conclusion, to be perfectly honest, and I say this, I'm a business guy. That's my primary job. I mean, that's been my career, not politics. And my conclusion is Congress will not deal with anything like Social Security where there's going to be some pain involved until there's a true crisis. 1982, the Greenspan Commission, where we had Tip O'Neill and Reagan finally cut a deal. It was a crisis. They were out of dough. They were out of money. They had to fix it or the checks weren't going to go out. Right now we're not at that point, and that's why Congress on both sides of the aisle would not come together and deal with it.
Okay. I'm going to ask one more question and then invite some questions from the audience. I think the arrangement in this room is that there are mics over to each side. And so if you have a question to ask me, you gather at the mics, and I'll turn to see if anyone's there after I've asked this next question. And it's about energy. Both of the candidates are talking in very strong terms about the need to address climate change. Both have expressed sympathy for a cap and trade approach to the issue, which would limit carbon emissions and auction permits to companies to emit carbon. But both candidates also, in electoral pandering mode, express deep concern about the skyrocketing cost of gasoline. I think that was how Obama put it. And as Austin reminded us, McCain proposed this gas tax holiday as a way to relieve some of the burden on the American electorate. So my question is this. How are you going, taking these guys at their word, and I apply this criticism to both of them, taking them at their word they want to do something about climate change. Doing something about climate change means making energy more expensive. Neither of them seem willing to make energy more expensive. What am I failing to understand? Austin, perhaps you could go
first.
Well,
I went first last time.
The good news is, since I don't work for anybody, I can be more candid. the bottom line, you're absolutely right. I mean, if we are truly interested in, number one, stopping our addiction to oil, I mean, the best way to do it is to raise the cost of oil. And obviously, the easiest way to ensure you do that is you tax it. But here is the bottom line. I mean, the political reality is that doesn't work. You know, the American people are going crazy with $4 gasoline. If you all of a sudden said it's going to be $5 gasoline, by the way, we're going to keep it at $5, and if the price of oil drops, then we will increase the tax to keep it at $5, you will be out of office so quick it'll make your head spin. I mean, that is not a politically acceptable way. I mean, it's just not doable. And you can say, oh, we need great political leadership.
I was just about to.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You know, you're going to have great political leadership that doesn't hold office. I mean, the American people, I mean, to be perfectly frank. And by the way, you know the reason we talk about cap and trade? That's a hidden tax. But we'd rather hide it. You know, the politicians want to hide it. They don't want to say, we're going to tax you. Well, let's hide it. But cap and trade is just a tax. Now, if you want me to talk about climate change, I would like to, because
Sure, just go ahead.
Yeah. And I don't know where Austin is on this.
We'll find out in just a moment.
But, you know, climate change is a serious problem, and President Bush recognizes it as a serious problem.
Tough crowd.
I'm gonna go on late night TV, I think, you know. I never knew I could create such laughter. That's unintentionally. However, if you look at, there are two challenges here in terms of controlling CO2 emissions. Number one is, no matter what you do in the short run, you're not going to be, the technology is not there right now. And it's not going to be there for 10 or 15 or 20 years. And it's a fact of life. It's just like tomorrow we can't stop using gasoline and stop using oil. Now, we need to move as quickly as we possibly can without harming our economy. But you can't do it overnight. It's a given. I mean, how many of you if you want to stop doing it, then start riding your bicycle. And how many of y'all only use your bicycle? Okay, there we got one. There, Carol Edelman, a good Republican over here. But seriously, you know, it's not physically possible. You know, who's going to quit using lights? It's not physically possible. But we need to accelerate the movement to alternative energy. And by the way, the president was more ambitious on that than Congress passed, the Democrat Congress passed last December. But secondly, and I know y'all don't want to hear this, but it is a fact, and I think Austin will agree with me. If the U.S. and Europe fixed our CO2 emissions, fixed them, and nothing happened in China and India and the other major emitters, we're not going to fix the problem. We're not even going to have an impact on the problem. It takes the whole world doing it. And that's why the president has brought together the top 15 economies, including China and India, basically the top 15 emitters, and is working with them to develop policies so everyone is committed to reducing CO2 emissions. It makes no sense for the U.S. to unilaterally do it. It will harm our economy and have no ultimate benefit to our globe. What's most important is that we bring everyone together and everyone gets committed, and that's what the president's working towards.
Austin, before you tell us about, you know, the international dimension of all this, if you want to respond to that point, I do still want to know how Obama proposes to reduce the use of energy without making energy more expensive.
Would it help if we made it more expensive?
You're asking me?
Yes.
You're the one who said he wanted it more expensive.
No. Would it help? Would we reduce our consumption if we put a tax on gasoline?
In a generic sense, sure.
And why don't we do that?
Now I got two moderators, and one of them is not to be trusted.
Austin, I thought we were good buddies.
It's not you, it's Clyde.
Oh.
That's what I'm saying. Now, look, the thing is this, and that is perhaps a good jumping off point. If you ask about personal consumption of energy as response, even just how much you drive your car in response to the price of energy, in the short run, the very short run, most of our energy consumption is locked in. It's locked in by where we're working. It's locked in by the vehicle we've chosen to drive, by where we live, by a bunch of things. In the longer run, we are able to adjust on many margins. our consumption of energy. I think that gives you some reason. You could say, I realize it is a bit like the old thing, Lord, please make me chaste, but not today. But there is a perfectly valid discussion about economic adjustment associated with the very short run versus the long run. So if you look at the cap and trade proposals, they don't just mandate an 80% reduction starting tomorrow. They're things that phase in over time because we believe that through research we can come up with new technologies, and people do need a period to adjust. You've had the price of oil rise 40% over the course of 80 days. And I do think there is, it's not hypocritical to say, whoa, wait a minute, we know we need to move to a alternative energy / lower energy consumption future. But if we triple the price of energy by Monday, it actually isn't going to solve that problem. It's largely just going to come straight out of the incomes of people because they can't move their house, buy a new car, et cetera. And you've seen the U.S. automakers, the dramatic impact that it's had on the sales of big vehicles, you know, for that reason. The adjustments take place, but they take place not on the scale of weeks, but on the scale of years. So I don't think it's totally
a timing issue.
I don't think it's totally contradictory or hypocritical to say, look, let's try to find ways to deal with the immediate crisis while simultaneously trying to put ourselves on a different path. Obama, as compared to McCain, they're both for cap and trade, but Obama's been substantially more aggressive about let's do the research and let's put in the money to try to develop alternative forms of energy at a cost-effective basis. McCain has opted more for that. Well, let's just try to up the drilling. Let's add 100 nuclear plants. And he hasn't been totally clear on whether or how much of the permits were even going to auction, so it's not clear we would even have money to invest in alternative energy.
And Obama's committed to auctioning all the permits, is he?
Yeah, that's in his plan. I mean, if you don't auction the permits, we need transition relief. But if you just start giving away free permits, A, you've opened up the system to lobbying and corruption because now it's who's the most connected are the ones who get free permits. And if you look in Europe, it's a very big problem. If you allow guys to give away free permits, it really undermines the environmental impact of a cap and trade. So without the investments in alternative energy, without McCain opposes the alternative energy production credits that are coming up for renewal right now. Without emphasis like that, I don't think you go anywhere. I mean, technology, we have to use the technology to try to address this problem. And if we don't, we have not. We're back to a situation 4, 8, 12 years from now where 2 months before the election, we're proposing 15-cent gas tax holidays. I mean, which aren't energy policies. They're just gimmicks to get to the next election.
I guess you could justify them on the grounds that it's all a question of timing. But anyway,
can I ask you a quick
I want to get to the audience. If there are people,
can I give advice?
It's hard to see because of the light.
Just keep talking while he calls on someone.
I think at the moment we've kind of got the balance.
I need two. I need 1 minute. I want to point out two things that are both two things. One is, I couldn't agree more with Austin that, you know, short term, we are where we are. And if we want to deal with the high price of fuel today and provide lower cost fuel, then we need to increase the supply. And the way you increase the supply is you drill more. And you drill in Anwar, let's hiss. You drill off in the outer continental shelf. And by the way, if President Clinton had not vetoed the Anwar bill that was passed by Congress in 1997, we were producing 1 million barrels a day out of Anwar today, and the cost of oil would be about, economists think, around $12 a barrel less. You know, we have to drill. For the short-term problem, we've got to open up drilling opportunities in America.
Drilling has no short-term impact. It takes 10 years.
It doesn't take 10. It takes 7 years. It will take time. There's no question, but we have to start now. Secondly, and this is important for y'all, I truly believe, having spent a lot of time looking at this, You know, we are getting very close to alternative energy being available, and I think it's going to happen. You're talking about plug-in hybrids by 2010 coming out of Toyota, coming out of Nissan, coming out of General Motors. A lot of people think by 2015 we'll actually have battery cars that are reasonably competitive, and the cost of an electric engine is, you know, an electric engine is three times more efficient than an internal combustion engine. The cost of electricity is significantly less than BTU value than gasoline. So the equivalent cost for a gallon of gasoline for an electric car is about 60 cents a gallon. So once we figure out the battery technology, and we are very, very close to figuring out that battery technology, you're going to have a dramatic shift. But before that happens, you know, we do need to make certain we have adequate supplies of oil. And the fact that we restrict it, we tie our hands. You know, we complain about oil not being too expensive, but yet we won't drill where we know it is. And so it's absolutely ridiculous that Senator Obama is opposed to drilling in areas that we know. And by the way, we know how to do it. We just had a giant hurricanes. You know, we had Katrina. We had the other major hurricanes on the Gulf Coast, and we had no spills. We know how to do this without having spills, and yet we don't do it. Sorry.
I want to move on and take some questions from the audience. Is there somebody there? I'm afraid
yes.
I can't see because of the...
We can't see.
The light is shining in my eyes, so you'll
That's
have to
great.
Be patient.
Thank you.
Go ahead, ask the question.
First, my name is Richard Palin. I live in Arizona now, but I lived in Massachusetts most of my life, and based on audience reaction, I feel like I'm right at home.
What's the question?
I'd like to focus on personal income taxes, okay, and a little bit of data. I recently had the opportunity to see National Tax Foundation data, which, as I read it correctly, it said that the top 10% of personal income tax data, excuse me, pay about 85% of taxes, as I recall. The top 50% of taxpayers pay approximately 95% of all personal income taxes, and the bottom 50% of taxpayers pay about 5% of all income taxes. There's been an awful lot of focus on the top 1% and the $102 million people, but the question, a policy question, is what percentage of total personal income taxes do people believe the top 10% of taxpayers ought to pay, which is currently around 85%? Thank you.
I think the proper question is not what share of taxes any group pays, it's what share of their income they pay, because the driving factor that's happening behind the scenes that you're not mentioning is that the incomes at the very top are growing at unprecedented rates, and the incomes of a whole bunch of people are stagnant. So the total tax revenue is not constant, so the share of that tax revenue is not the relevant comparison. Of the top 1%, they now pay about 21% of their income in taxes. That's modestly higher than, as you go down, that number is, let's say, about 19% for the top 15%, not including the top guys. And under the Obama program, the top 1%'s share of their income would go up by about 3%. Given the double-digit growth in incomes of that group, I don't consider that to be particularly problematic. It's nothing like the scare tactic of saying, the marginal rates will be 10 zillion percent. But I think it does know, the way you have phrased the question, just the framing of the question, points you to some argument that, well, the people that are doing well are already taxed too much, they pay 90% of the total or whatever you said. You do have to remember what is the context of how the economy is doing overall, and you can't forget that for a large majority of the country, their incomes are not rising. So to ask them to pay a greater share of the tax revenue would be rather unusual. It is important, as Al said, to raise. It's not attempting to bring down the top. It is attempting to separate out, let us say, investments in education from rewarding Paris Hilton, who, as far as I know, does not have a PhD, but is going to receive a fair amount of money. At the bottom,
she has a PhD in marketing and promotion.
Yeah. So the thing is, if you want to close the, if you want higher productivity and higher incomes for the rest of America, by the rest, I don't mean the bottom, I mean 80, 85%. You invest in college affordability. You invest in K through 12 education, and you make important investments that Senator Obama has outlined are the core of his domestic program, and which Senator McCain is saying, no, that's wasteful spending. The government shouldn't be making those investments. So I don't think you can take the tax part out of the broader economic context.
Let's move on, if you don't mind, Al. We already know what you think about taxes. Is there a question over here?
There are actually people here. My name's Larry Gelman, and I had a question about a lot of the comments being made today. It seems as though a lot of the discussion is about taxes and who should be paying more and who should be paying less. And I hear no serious conversation coming out of either side in Washington about how we're going to pay our bills. I mean, it seems to me that here we are almost $1 trillion into a war. I've never heard a serious discussion from the president or anyone else about how we're going to pay for it. All the energy seems to be going to demonizing people on the other side and treating the whole electorate like they were little children that can't handle the truth. I remember when I first got in the investment business, there was a guy by the name of Paul Volcker who ran interest rates up to 22% in the short run. The stock market had provided zero return for 15 years. Ronald Reagan then came in and got the credit, but basically because he was willing to put a country through pain and squeeze the inflation out of the system, we were able to have the stock market go up 1,000% over the next 10 years. So I guess my question is, given the state of the blogosphere and the state of campaign tactics and Rovian campaigning and what have you, are we ever going to be able to have a serious conversation about anything from either side, or is it all going to just keep being showing how bad and stupid the other guy is?
Yeah, wasn't this supposed to be a post-partisan election? We got off to a bad start, didn't we, if that's the case?
Terrible.
So what do you say to this?
Okay, I would say three short things. First, Paul Volcker is a great American. You should listen to anything Paul Volcker says, and Paul Volcker has endorsed Barack Obama and wrote a very long letter saying why he thinks he should be the president. Two, I do think we need to build a consensus. That the issues of building consensus and getting past partisanship and how do we pay our bills are two separate issues, but they are related, obviously. On getting past partisan division, look, it's an election. There's going to be a partisan division because we have to vote. But in fairness, I do think Barack Obama and John McCain are within their parties the two. Each one is the figure within their party who has the best chance to do that. In Senator Obama's case, I think that in his domestic program, around many of the domestic investments that we need to get the country back growing again, there is a growing consensus with people on both sides. One example is investment in infrastructure. The Chamber of Commerce has now identified investment in our infrastructure is going to be their number one issue for the coming year. I think there are a number of issues, be they education, infrastructure, alternative energy policy, where there is the possibility of building consensus, and Senator Obama's totally committed to that. Personally, that's the kind of person he is. On the issue of paying the bills, these guys dug us a very big hole. Senator Obama has said he doesn't want to increase the deficit. The Tax Policy Center and the Wall Street Journal have looked at his budget and said he wouldn't increase the deficit. John McCain's program is not that. It's a massive increase in the deficit. So if you're worried about paying the bills, I don't think you got to be worried about McCain being the president.
Okay, well, so much for post-partisanship. Al, you respond.
You know, I think as a American who currently lives in Indiana, I've lived there most of my adult life, grew up near Memphis, we've got a problem with both sides spending money unnecessarily. And we have a problem with both sides not dealing with the big fiscal challenge facing our country, which is entitlements. You know, I've talked about Social Security. That's a $13 trillion unfunded liability. Medicare is a $70 trillion unfunded liability. $70 trillion unfunded liability. They dwarf all the other fiscal challenges we have. But if you look at individual bills, I mean, the recent farm bill, you know, farmers are making more money than they've ever made in the history of the country this year because of these incredibly high commodity prices, which we all know about. Well, Congress just passed a bigger farm bill than we had with the last farm bill. Makes absolutely no sense. We're subsidizing farmers to when they don't need subsidies. And by the way, that farm bill also paid money to everybody else so they could get everybody to vote for the farm bill. I mean, we have a serious spending problem. And by the way, it's both sides of the aisle. I hate to say it. And I think that's why the Republicans got killed in 06 is because we were fiscally were not responsible. And the American people said, you know, why should we vote for you if you're not going to do what you said you're going to do fiscal, in terms of fiscal responsibility? I think your question, you know, Paul Volcker was, he was, I mean, and I'm sorry that he's endorsed Obama, but there's no question that what he did in the early 80s was, I mean, was remarkable, absolutely remarkable. I mean, I suffered. I was a business guy. I paid literally 22% in interest rates, but it had to be done, and he had the fortitude to do it, and it had to be done, and we need some kind of leadership like that at the presidential level in terms of fiscal responsibility. I will say this. If you look at John McCain, his record over the last 20 years in Congress, or however long he's been, 25 years, been in Congress, is he's voted against earmarks always. He's never asked for earmarks for his constituency. He's voted against spending. He is a fiscal conservative, and I think you can count on him as, if he's president, he's going to do his damnedest to cut, and he's not afraid to embarrass Congress. I wish President Bush had put more pressure on Congress to curb spending, and I think President McCain will put enormous pressure on Congress to curb spending and enormous pressure on Congress to deal with entitlements.
Okay, next question. Next question. Maybe you could stand close to the mic. I can't hear you.
Look, the issue of the dollar, this came up yesterday when we had Jake. I don't actually think, I don't think anybody, country gets rich by devaluing their currency. I just don't think that works. As the dollar has gone down, it's true, it's helped our exports. But I have been troubled by viewing how things have taken place. I believe that there's no question the root of, if you are concerned about the decline of the dollar, the origins of the decline of the dollar are centered in runaway fiscal irresponsibility in which we don't have the domestic savings to cover what we need and we have to borrow money from abroad. Okay, so we've had a humongous run-up in borrowing from abroad, and that's put pressure on the dollar. Ben Bernanke, I tell the story, Ben Bernanke was an academic, and a bunch of my monetary and macroeconomics colleagues get up each morning and have gotten up, look in the mirror and say, why not me? You know, if Bernanke's there, why should I be there? And for the last 8 months or so, it's more they get up and they say, phew, not me, him, because he's in a tough spot. You've got inflation already outside the target zone. You've got a slowing economy, as we've discussed before, which would normally make you think, hey, well, let's cut rates. But if you cut rates, it's going to devalue the dollar further. If you're concerned about that, you have to think about addressing the issues of fiscal responsibility and our need to borrow from abroad. And the thought of running the deficit up another $300-400 billion a year is not a good sign for where you think the dollar would be. The only other thing to remember is that the dollar's devaluation has taken place only relative to the currencies where they're floating. So on a trade-weighted basis, the dollar isn't down very much because you got China and a bunch of countries in Asia just continuing to devalue their own currency to stay pegged to the dollar to continue to promote their own manufacturing. So that's adds a little wrinkle that's a bit hard to deal with.
Obviously, none of us want the dollar to be weak. My wife and I just returned from France, and I could promise you we don't want our dollar to be weak if we like traveling overseas. France, it's twice the cost of New York. It's just mind-boggling. We paid $54 for two glasses of white wine, and it's just white wine over the, you know, just whatever the bar had. We needed two more glasses just to get over it. In terms of the value of the dollar, you know, there are a number of things that contribute to it. There is the current account deficit, by the way, which started during the Clinton administration and grew during the Clinton administration, continued to grow under the Bush administration. The last 2 years, it's actually declined a little bit. However, you know, current account deficits have never been tied to economic growth, and we've continued to have good economic growth during the current account deficit. These things do go on for long periods of time. I think the biggest contributor to our current situation is the fact that in Europe, you know, the European Central Bank just raised their rates to 4.25%. Ben's and the Fed has our rate at 2%. There's that 2.25% differential. Obviously, if you have a choice of putting your money where you're going to get 4.25 versus 2, you go to the 4.25, and I think that has a major impact on depreciating the dollar. The best thing that could happen to strengthen our dollar is for our economy to strengthen. Once our economy strengthens, you can be assured the Fed will raise rates. They will raise it initially to the neutral zone, which is in the Austin would know this better than I, but my guess is around 4.5%, between 4 and 5%, which would put us on at the same level as Europe, and that would have a major impact on the value of the dollar. Long term, what's most important in terms of strengthening our dollar is to ensure that we have the strongest economy absolutely possible, and the key ingredients to that are productivity growth, and control of inflation. Obviously, we need a higher savings rate. And because we have a low savings rate, Austin is absolutely right, that means that investment dollars have to come from abroad. The other thing that would be a huge benefit, in China, believe it or not, their savings rate is 50%. And their leaders have talked about that they hope to be moving to an economy that's more consumptive oriented. Because after all, it would be a benefit to the Chinese people. So, you know, there are a lot of disequilibriums right now, but the most important thing that we can do is make sure we're doing everything possible to strengthen our economy so the Fed will raise rates, and that will have a direct impact on the value of the dollar.
Another question.
All right. Thank you. Al, I was very impressed that you acknowledged the fiscal train wrecks we're facing. What I'd like to understand is how the issue of controlling spending, earmarks, the farm bill, they're peanuts compared to this crisis of health care, Social Security, infrastructure. How do we connect the dots on dealing with these fiscal train wrecks and the supply side notion of great additional tax cuts? Jack Kemp yesterday said, well, we just have to grow the economy 5 or 6% a year. I don't know when the last time we did that, but maybe you can answer that question for me. But if we're not growing the economy at 5 or 6% a year, how are we going to connect these dots? A supply side cut, yet we have these huge fiscal train wrecks.
I'm not sure. We've kind of covered this area. I'm not sure. Do you have something?
Well, no, I don't think he can. He's saying two things. He says we've got huge fiscal train wreck, but he's great support of these huge tax cuts. Help me understand how we connect those dots.
You don't.
You need to go through them one at a time. On Social Security, to be honest, the Social Security is the easiest one to fix, and it's pure arithmetic. It is easy to project how much benefits we're going to have to pay out under the current system. And you have three choices with Social Security. And just to be totally frank, you know, you can raise taxes enormously, and you can't just do it through payroll taxes. You got to raise taxes enormously if you don't deal with benefits. So that's one way. Another way is you dramatically cut back on benefits, and again, that's politically not acceptable. Or you do a combination of the two, and that's the way it's going to have to be done. But the interesting thing is, right now, Social Security benefits are indexed. This is probably too much detail, but they're indexed to the growth in wages. If you indexed Social Security benefits to inflation, as opposed to wages, that fixes the problem overnight. Fixes the problem overnight. You don't have to raise the retirement age. You don't have to do anything. If you just, if what we said was your Social Security benefits are not going to go up beyond cost of living, it would be fixed. But if a politician ran on that, he would be condemned for cutting Social Security benefits. And that's why it's so hard.
Just on a point of information, Britain did that some 20 years ago, and it proved politically unsustainable.
Really?
Because state pensions fell so far behind rising living standards elsewhere in the economy, people began to complain, and the link to wages had just been restored.
Oh, is that
so
right?
So it's a very politically a very difficult thing to sustain. Let's take another question, if you don't mind.
Yes, I'm Mike Peters. I'm with the New York Times. I mean, actually, I'm not with the New York Times, but I read the New York Times.
A distinction of no importance.
What is, which is worse?
But Alan, you said that even if America cut its emissions, it won't mean anything for a lot of the other countries who aren't cutting their emissions. And my question or my point is, don't underestimate our effect in the world. Do you remember 15 years ago, America passed these laws saying you can't smoke in bars and stuff, and now all over the world they're doing it because we did it. So I just wanted to bring that up. Thank you.
Yeah, I would like to.
That's an example. It's a good point.
Can I respond to that? Because I heard Tom Friedman the other day say we should do it and then everyone will follow us. Well, obviously we have excellent environmental laws that contain non CO2 emissions. And that's why we have as good of air and water, et cetera, as we do, and it's been dramatically improved over the last 30 or 40 years. I don't know how many of you have been to Beijing recently. I can assure you they are not following our example, and that's the point. We cannot count on they will not follow our example unless we make that part of the deal. We've got to work together. We've got to bring them to they got to be at the table. India has to be at the table. Europe has to be at the table. The other, however many, the other 11 major emitters have to be at the table, and we all have to agree on doing it together.
I would just make the following point, and maybe Thomas Friedman already made it. If so, I apologize for repeating. I think it's I think to not do anything, A, it's clear if you go to China and say, look, why don't you guys bite the bullet, do these things, and they say, wait a minute, you're the biggest emitter and you're not doing anything. Why should we move before you move? It is important we work together, but let's not forget the opportunity there. There's a reason why if you look at internet and computer related stuff, the Silicon Valley is in Silicon Valley. The Silicon Valley of biotechnology is either in Cambridge, Massachusetts or South San Francisco. The Silicon Valley of a whole bunch of technologies are in the United States. But the Silicon Valleys of green tech and alternative energy are not in America. And that's because that's not where the demand is. That's not where the big market is. If we do control our emissions, if we put a price on carbon, if we put a focus on that, there's very much the opportunity for the U.S. to make that an engine, one engine of future growth. And if we don't act, it will never be that. It will remain in Germany and Spain and the places where where there's a lot of demand for that kind of thing. That's where they will develop the production technology. So I hope we don't forget that.
Just one other point on climate, which I think is important. I mean, this is we've discussed this a lot within the Bush administration. What we need to do is develop the technology, the alternative energy technology that is CO2 clean, that is competitive with carbon-based technology, and that's when you can easily convince the Chinese and the Indians to switch to that technology, and that's why it is so important that we make the investment in technology.
Okay, I'm so sorry. We're out of time. We have to draw it to a close. Please join me in thanking our panelists.
Austin.